This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. As the year winds down and you look back at the last months, what science stories really do you remember? What sticks in your mind? This hour, we're going to take a look at the biggest stories in science and technology of this past year. Will it be the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, which has claimed the lives of over 6,000 people? Were you captivated by the European Space Agency's Rosetta mission and its bouncy landing on the comet 67P? What about the announcements by scientists that they had found the missing piece of the cosmic inflation puzzle? Maybe? And then they seem to have lost that puzzle piece, maybe retracting it. We won't be taking your calls today, but for more on what we'll be talking about this hour, go to sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. Our panel of science editors and writers is here. Let me introduce the panel. Mariette Christina is the editor-in-chief and senior vice president of Scientific American here in New York. Always good to see you.
All right. Likewise, Ira. Thanks.
Liz Cruzy is a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. She's based out of Austin, Texas. Howdy to you, Liz.
Howdy, y'all.
Bridget Carey is host of the CNET Update and senior editor at CNET.com here in New York. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Mariette, start us off this year with your top science story on Scientific American's list. Is it the Ebola outbreak, I guess?
All right, how did you know?
I can read my notes right here.
Awesome. Those are awesome notes. Right. How could we let 2014 go by without talking about the Ebola virus, which was so in the news? Although, of course, we've known of that type of virus for a few decades now. Only this year did it really come to the fore as a public policy issue, as well as one of many lives. You mentioned 6,000 killed. That's with 17,000 infected, and it's of a class of viruses, including the Marburg virus, that are among the most lethal known to man. And yet it is also not as easy to catch as the flu, which, by the way, kills many tens of thousands more every year because it is not airborne. And among the things we learned about Ebola this year were a little bit more about its rather interesting and complex lifestyle, and at least some initial measures that we can take in public health areas while we are working on vaccines and longer-term solutions.
Are you surprised that it has sort of fallen off the radar screen, even though it is still raging over there in Liberia?
Yeah. Well, you know, the radar screen here is one kind of radar screen, and the radar screen for the global health officials is another kind of radar screen. So I'm sure that here in the U.S., where we currently don't have, intense news activity around it, it's fallen off the radar a little bit. But elsewhere, people are really still paying attention to it. And we know that we've been able to start to apply some understanding a little bit of how to treat at least the symptoms. Rehydration is really important for this disease. We've also learned that electrolytes and supplementing those is really important, but we've also learned that it's not, people used to characterize it as a kind of a bleed out disease, but it doesn't. While people who are infected bleed internally, it's not something where, unless you come in really direct contact. So we learned some things, some areas where we need to be concerned and where we need to focus more, but also areas where we can establish some rational thinking around that initial sense of terror. How are we going to grapple with this?
Mm-hmm. Okay, Liz Cruzy, what's at the top of your list?
I have to say, European Space Agency landing its Philae lander on a comet. I mean, it dropped 22 kilometers, 14 miles, and these things are traveling pretty fast. And even though, as you mentioned, it had a sort of bouncy landing and things didn't go quite as planned, it's still just a feat of engineering. And so far, it's starting to send back, the Philae lander sent back a little bit of data and some images, awesome images from the surface of a comet. But Rosetta, the mothership, so to speak, has also been sending back some pretty awesome science. So, there's a lot more to come as the comet itself gets closer and closer to the sun. So that's another thing to keep out for next year, too.
Were you surprised at how much attention that got? I was pleasantly surprised to see that.
Oh, it was awesome to see. I think comet landing was one of the top three trending hashtags for that day on Twitter, and just how people were so excited about it throughout mass media, but just everyone on the street knew that this had happened. It was pretty awesome.
And so what's the state of it now? It's sort of sitting there in the shadow, and it's powered down?
Yeah, so Philae was able to relay some data for, I think it was 50 to 60 hours. I can't remember the exact number. And it's sort of gone into hibernation. It landed kind of on its side in shadow. So the solar panels to continue energizing it were blocked from the light, from sunlight. So as the comet itself gets closer and closer to the sun, there maybe some of that sunlight will hit the solar panels and sort of rebirth, I guess, the lander.
We're reawakening it up, reinvigorating.
Yes, that's probably a much better way of putting it.
Mariette Rosetta also made Scientific American's list, right?
Yeah, of course it did. I mean, what a fantastic... I mean, people will tend to cling to the, oh, it didn't land perfectly, oh, it had to shut down, but no matter what, it returned some fantastic data already, and we just can't wait to learn more about that in the coming year as well.
Yeah. Bridget, Home Depot, one of my favorite places to hang out. My kids won't go with me because I get lost in the store. Had one of the largest data breaches of this year, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it wasn't even just Home Depot. We had hacks from the very beginning of the year all the way until now. We're talking a lot about Sony. I mean, you can really say this was the year of the hack. I mean, it started in the holidays last year. You heard about Target. And then Home Depot just was even larger than that. With Home Depot, hackers were in computers unnoticed for 5 months, and they just scooped up 56 million credit and debit cards in addition to all those millions of emails, 53 million email accounts. This was a year of the wake-up call for hacking, and we had Heartbleed back in April.
Right.
Everyone was talking about that when it comes to realizing that this secure way that websites were talking to each other wasn't really all that secure. And when the warnings weren't heeded, there were consequences to that. We had Health Systems Hospital Network. They were hacked with 4.5 million records stolen. It was a pretty serious year. It seems like every month there was another hack story. It just goes on and on.
It was also the year at the same time where we tried to get more secure in the way we buy things, right? There's Apple that came out with a new technology.
Exactly, Apple Pay. It was interesting timing for that, because if we had Apple Pay already installed, hacks like Target and Home Depot wouldn't have actually happened. They wouldn't have been as serious, because when it comes to Apple Pay, what you do when you use your phone to tap to pay to the register, it has this code that is a one-time use code. It's not actually giving the retailer your credit card number. So if someone hacked in, those codes are useless to them. And you have to now be more awakened to this kind of issue when retailers aren't taking matters into their own hands. Consumers are probably looking to Apple Pay and Google Wallet going, maybe this is something that we should start taking advantage of and put the control back in our own hands.
But Bridget, not all retailers are accepting Apple Pay, and that sort of creates a competition there, doesn't it?
Oh, it's a mess right now. I mean, you have it, but then you don't know which one works with who. I mean, you have McDonald's uses it, but Wendy's doesn't, and they'll use a competitor system, and
right.
It goes on and on. If it's like Macy's has it, but JCPenney's doesn't, you know. So you're kind of discouraged to even use the technology when it's that mixed up. Apple did announce that they have a few more vendors, and they're trying to, you know, keep making partnerships and having it grow. But until you can just use it anywhere,
yeah.
I mean, you know, you're kind of discouraged a little bit. You'd rather just take out your wallet.
Let's talk about something that may have happened and maybe then didn't happen. And that's when scientists announced and then retracted that they had observed waves from just a fraction of a second after the Big Bang. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this was a pretty big story when pretty hyped up back in March, when astronomers with the BICEP 2 telescope down at the South Pole announced that they saw this pattern of waves from the first instant in the universe. So this pattern that they saw turned out it could also come from dust in our galaxy. And so there was a lot of back and forth about whether it came from the dust, whether it came from these first ripples in the universe's existence. And some very vocal scientists on both sides of it. Then in September, the Planck Space Telescope had actually mapped the dust in our galaxy or across the sky and said that, yep, there's a lot more dust there than the BICEP 2 team had seen. So they still don't know if the Bicep 2, that original March discovery announcement, saw this these ripples from the early universe, or if it's all from the dust in our galaxy. It could be part of both. And so future studies, I guess, will hopefully say more. But I think it's really a fascinating story about the way science works, and it really played out sort of in public light this year. So whether they saw, whatever they saw, it still shows yeah. you how science works.
It's sort of a story of how science is self-correcting sometime, isn't it, Mariette?
Yeah. Exactly. And it's not one discovery, usually, or one study that's going to answer this huge question about how the universe began. It takes a lot more than that, and scientists use what they have at the time to come to their current conclusions, and things are constantly refined.
Do you want to follow up, Mary?
Oh, I was just
thinking. Fascinating lesson, isn't it?
Yeah, it's actually two things sprung to mind listening to Liz's great summary. One is I'm reminded of the Higgs boson discovery,
right.
And how scientists were so careful to try to describe the data sets, the accuracy, remember the sigma, levels and so on. And one of the scientists, the head of CERN, the lab there, gave a metaphor that I thought equally applies here, which is it's kind of like when you're piling up these data sets, you think you see your friend in the distance, but as you get more close, he starts to come into focus. And I feel like a lot of these large, complicated data sets from various instruments, like the BICEP results and the Planck satellite, are that overlapping of data sets. And it is, Ira, a wonderful thing about science, that science does self-correct in light of new data. And I just am also thinking, I was smiling at you, because last night I was driving home from university with my daughter, who's in her first year, and she was waxing on about how, why wouldn't anybody listen to science? Because it does this kind of self-correction. And I thought, out of the mouths of, well, babe. So she'd get mad at me for the babe comment. But
We'll not say that you said that.
Yes, thank you.
We're going to have to take a break when we come back, and we're going to come back with lots more of the top science stories of 2014. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the year's biggest science stories with my guests, Liz Cruzy, who is contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine, Bridget Carey, senior editor at CNET here in New York, Mariette DiCristina, editor-in-chief and senior vice president of Scientific American here in New York. And we're going to go back to talking about what the biggest stories of the year are. Let's talk about the drought, Mariette. Isn't that an incredible story?
An incredible story. And actually, I'd like to reflect really quickly. I think it was last year, Ira, when I said on this show, or it might have been the year before, but I think it was last year, that I thought that 2013 would be the year we all started to pay attention to climate. And I think 2014, I'm going to go out on a tiny limb here and say that maybe this is the year that we all can say globally we began to take some focused action. And the drought in California was another symptom of a changed climate. But could I also just give you a couple of highlights of actions that were taken?
Sure.
Because I was really kind of, after being depressed for years about climate, I'm feeling maybe a little more hopeful, although certainly there's a giant problem that we haven't yet solved. But if we look at this year, if we look at the U.S. and China agreement to cut emissions, which was very recently announced in November, if we look at the 28-nation accord of the European Union also to cut carbon by 40% below 1990 levels, then we've got something like on the order of half or 40% or so of the major emitters in the world who've now committed to reducing carbon to some level. Is it enough yet? Probably not enough. But that was fantastic. And this year also was the fifth iteration of findings from the International Panel over Climate Change, the UN IPCC. And yes, humans still accounting for the major changes in climate. And yes, the problem is worsening, but I was very encouraged. And I could list out for you a half a dozen other signals, both on the evidence to the climate side that the public are now seeing, and also nations, including the Lima. Which was just very recently, that are very encouraging as well. So I think that was a huge, for me, maybe even a major, more of a major signal, personally, as a journalist, the climate shift.
You're going to make a prediction about 2015? Is it going to continue in this trend, do you think?
I hope the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. I'm going to, you know, I'm of course, in making a prediction, you know, everybody is always hesitant to that. But if you think about it, we had another climate summit with 100 heads of state, including Obama, that the UN Secretary General held. We had we had the Lima Accords, which you mentioned. Last year, I go to the World Economic Forum meetings at Davos in January. There were more than 20 sessions, a record number of sessions, devoted to climate change issues. So I take this as, you know, people getting the message and starting to move
forward.
And
not only that, but the people took to the streets this year.
In New York, 100,000 people?
In Australia and all different places. That, I've always said, we'll know it's serious when the 60s are back and people are taken to the streets again, you know? Well, and they did this year.
Yeah, and then let's look at some of the hard things, too. 400 parts per million of carbon in the year now. We just hit that record. Nobody's happy about that. We are on track to be the hottest year on record for the 38th year in a row, I think it is. The California drought that we kicked off this discussion with has already been responsible for a loss of $2.2 billion in lost crops. And by the way, the flash floods are not helping, if people think that is, because it just runs over the parched land and it's kind of lost. So we're seeing both seriously encouraging signals to continue, but also some really hopeful signs that people at last are gathering together to try to address this global problem in a global way.
You bring on another voice, because this year it seemed like scientists were digging up a new fossil every other week. Paleontologists really know how to pick a good name for them. Also, there was the 11-foot-tall chicken from hell, I hope you didn't miss that one, to the dreadnoughtus, which that would have feared nothing, as they said, because this was like the dinosaur's dinosaur. I want to bring on Brian Switek. He is science writer and author of Lelap's blog at the National Geographic. He joins us from KCPW in Salt Lake. Welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me back on.
The dinosaurs whose name means terrible hands got a body this year, right?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the biggest stories in all of paleontology. As a kid, I'd, you know, see all these books that would just have these disembodied arms in them, and that was all that there was. It was an animal called a Deinocheirus that was found in the 1960s. And for years, nobody knew what it looked like. And even when paleontologists went back to the original quarry, all they found was some bitten bone fragments. So the original specimen had been basically torn apart, and that's why there wasn't any more. But this year, they finally announced what the rest of the body looked like. And it's really strange. It's one of the weirdest looking dinosaurs I think anybody has ever found. So the front of the head, it kind of looks like a duck-billed dinosaur, this shovel beak, kind of wide, flaring mouth sort of thing, with a long neck, 8-foot-long arms, and a sail over its back, and at the tip of its tail, this fan of feathers. So you have an animal about the size of T-Rex that has like Arnold Schwarzenegger arms almost, with, you know, a duck's head and a sail back. It's incredibly strange.
Huh. And then we had the 86-foot-long dreadnoughtus uncovered.
Yeah, that's a great, great name. And it really speaks to the size of this animal. Now, it wasn't, you know, the biggest dinosaur of all time, but it's the largest one that we can get a good estimate of what its size actually was, because we actually have front limbs and hind limbs that leads to better mass estimates for this animal. And that's one of the sad ironies of some of these really huge dinosaurs. They're so big, they didn't really get buried fast enough to get preserved. So now finally, you know, Ken Lacovara at Drexel and his colleagues, by digging this animal up and finally publishing it, they're really starting to get a good idea of what these super giant dinosaurs were actually like. I mean, most of the biggest ones like Argentinosaurus and Supersaurus and all those other ones that you might have heard about, they're just fragments, really. But this one, it's complete enough. We can start to get an idea of what the muscle attachments are like, maybe how it moved. So naming it is really just step one in this bigger process of figuring out how these animals actually lived.
There was an aquatic dinosaur uncovered too, right?
Yeah, so that was another one of these long-standing mysteries. So it's an animal called Spinosaurus that was discovered during the early part of the 20th century. The original bones were destroyed during World War II during an Allied bombing raid on Munich. And little bits and pieces would come out of Morocco and Egypt now and then. But this year, a paper was published on the hind limbs of this animal and some skull pieces and some other bits. But by combining all this, all these isolated elements, we get a bigger picture of what Spinosaurus actually looked like. So this is another another animal. It's about T-Rex size, around 40 feet long or so. It has this long crocodile-like snout, a sail over its back, but its legs look really kind of puny compared to the rest of it. And there's some debate about whether they were scaled properly to the rest of the body, whether it really belongs to this dinosaur or not. So that's something that, you know, experts are going to continue to debate for a number of years. But if this new reconstruction is correct, this is an animal that's a lot more at home in the water than on the land. One of the really weird things is that when they cut into the bones and they did histological sections, they saw they're incredibly dense, almost like early whale bones, that this kind of bone ballast to, you know, achieve neutral buoyancy in the water so it's not struggling to stay under the water. This dinosaur seemed to have evolved almost in the same way as early whales did. So if all this is correct, this might be the first dinosaur that we know of that was spending a great deal of its time kind of sculling around the Cretaceous waterways.
Wow. Well, we're giving the PR people for all these dinosaur finds new bones, so to speak, to outdo each other with a new name.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, with a new dinosaur named about every 2 weeks, I'm sure we're going to see a lot more great names coming to us throughout 2015 and into the future.
Well, Brian, thank you for taking time to be with us today. We'll have you back for the next dinosaur, okay?
You bet.
Brian Sweetek, a science writer and author of Lelep's blog at National Geographic. He was joining us from KCPW in Salt Lake City. Let's talk to our panel here. We've got lots more questions to talk about, and besides the dinosaurs, there's a lot more interesting stuff. We had smartwatches.
Oh,
wearables,
did we?
Finally.
Did we have smartwatches? We
did
had
we? We did.
Six alone from Samsung. I think it's overwhelming the market, and consumers don't even know what is happening anymore because they're just throwing them out there, hoping something sticks. And then you hear about Apple's upcoming Apple Watch, which will come out sometime in the early part of next year. But they're all right now struggling with battery life, and they're doing the same kinds of notifications that you find on your phone. So aside from the, hey, look at me, cool factor, there's going to be this moment of, well, what's the extra use out of it? You know, if I can still just glance at my phone, why do I need this? A lot of the marketing that's being done is, hey, you don't have to ever take your phone out of your pocket, which is great because phones are now like 6 inches and bigger. So you can't even squeeze it in your pocket
to
begin with.
By the time you get it out, you forgot why you were doing that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's that moment of, well, if I just glance at my Facebook notification on my wrist, then I can still play with my kids. I mean, that's right. What they're going with the marketing now. But I think there's going to be a new aha moment in the upcoming year. And that's going to be with what Apple Watch has is something that no other watch has. And that's Apple Pay, which we were talking about before the break. The fact that you can now pay with a wave of your wrist, and it goes beyond payments. It's being able to activate things with your wrist. You can go into a hotel room, and instead of having the card key, you wave your wrist to open the door. Mm. We're seeing a lot of that more in different places. What if you could just pay for your subway, you know, ticket by waving your wrist at the turnstile? When that starts to be implemented more and more, MasterCard's also testing this out with their own type of wristband for payments, I think then you have that moment of, oh, this is actually useful. I could just wave and I get things done.
Anything new with Oculus Rift? Is a real consumer model going to be coming out?
Well, we have the first model that we can buy with Samsung's partnership with Oculus. That's the virtual reality system they have, where it's called Gear VR. It's $200, and you still need to buy a special kind of phone just to use it, because you have to put a Galaxy Note 4 in your visor on your head. This is interesting stuff. It has about like 17 goofy apps to start, you know, things like look around in space and some games. But with Oculus, I think they have a lot to go to get past that I'm going to throw up point. Because right now it just makes you so nauseous.
It does.
Yeah. I mean, I've used
it.
I've played a couple games on it. I don't last very long, aside from the fact that they always keep throwing at me scary video games. It's the fact that it disorients you. And they also have programs they're coming out with where you can work out like an exercise while wearing these virtual reality headsets. I think that's more show off than useful right now.
Yeah, I hate to get dizzy while I'm working out and fall off whatever.
It's hard enough to get motivated as it is.
Liz, let's talk about what a year for commercial spaceflight, the good news and the bad news this year.
Yeah, so it's definitely was an up and down year. You know, good news was NASA's Orion capsule, which went through a test just earlier this month. Two orbits around Earth, 4 hours. Everything seemed to go fine. Other good news was SpaceX is still chugging right along, sending missions up, sending its Dragon space capsule up to the International Space Station to replenish and to bring some science instruments and experiments up there. The bad news happened one right after the other in October. So Orbital Sciences Corporation was supposed to be sending up a capsule to the International Space Station, again, for replenishing. And just a few seconds after launch, it exploded. And that was pretty sad. Luckily, there were no fatalities, no injuries regarding that. And then, of course, just a few days after that, Virgin Galactic Spaceship 2 crashed, and sadly, there was a fatality and another injury. So it's been up and down. You know, commercial spaceflight, just like any spaceflight, will get through it and become better from it. But it's definitely that week at the end of October was pretty traumatic, I think.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Seems like in the history of spaceflight, October is a big month, and historically speaking, Sputnik, whatever. Now, the Orion, where does it go from here, though? It had a two-orbit tour, you know, and will it ever go anywhere besides Earth orbit? Because even though it was a triumph for NASA, we don't have any money, a plan, a way of doing anything later with it, do we?
Well, NASA's getting a little more money. I know they squeaked a bit more out of the budget for 2015. They are working on a space launch system, a heavy lift rocket, to get the Orion capsule back to the moon, to especially an asteroid, near Earth asteroid. That's the goal, is the mid-20s, and potentially Mars in the 30s. But the technology isn't really there right now. And they're... You know, when the Obama administration kind of took over, they altered what the spaceflight budget was. I mean, this happens every time the new administration comes in. And so it seems like the big projects kind of get hit. Some of the technology could still chug along. I mean, the Orion and the Space Launch System is actually very similar to, except scaled down, to one that the Bush administration had put forth. But it had a few years off, and it's sort of the scaled back version. So we'll see what happens with the next presidential administration, because the Orion and Space Launch System isn't even scheduled for a test flight until 2018. And I mean, that can easily slip given what's happened in the past. And
we had, NASA, when we were talking about it, one of our experts made the comment that, you know, if this were back in the 60s, when you had the first test launch, 2 years later, we were on the moon. Right, Marriott?
I remember it so well.
You know, I mean, it's just two years to go, and here we're now. We don't even know when the next one's going to happen.
And also, I just want to mention on the broader side of things, I mean, for anybody who's thinking that, you know, what NASA does for U.S. spaceflight and other companies that are involved in that, there's a huge economic factor here that I don't think a lot of people appreciate. The phones that we use, the satellite communication, the telecom, the shows and cable, and so, you know, broadcasts that we are based on, all of that is driven by space-related technology. So it's intimately the multi-billion-dollar industry.
But maybe another country that gets to the moon before us.
Maybe
Elon Musk will get there before we.
Maybe he
says
will.
He could do it faster, cheaper. we also had the Indians were active, were they not, in sending probes to Mars?
Yeah, it was the first time an agency or a country has sent a probe to Mars to orbit it on the first try. NASA had failures, Soviet Union had failures, but India seemed to do it, and on a pretty menial budget. So we'll see where they go. They're clearly showing that they're a pretty big factor in space exploration in the future.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk lots more about science and technology stories this year with my guest, Marriott DeChristina, Editor-in-Chief, Senior Vice President of Scientific American, Liz Cruzy, Contributing Editor at Astronomy Magazine, Bridget Carey, Senior Editor at CNET.com, and host of the CNET Update. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the top science and technology stories of this year with Mariette DeCristina, Liz Cruzy, Bridget Carey. And if you've got science stories you'd like to suggest, go to our website. Send us a note there at sciencefriday.com, and we'll put them up there, and you can tell us what you think. Or go to our website at scifry.com and tweet us. You can also tweet us at scifry and leave us some stuff at Facebook. And let us know what you think the big science stories of the year are. Let's talk about other stories now. You have a story that you want to pitch?
Oh, yeah.
Let's
talk about drones.
Oh, drones, of course.
Yeah.
I don't get my pizza yet delivered that way.
Yeah, can't get pizza via drone just yet. But, you know, they're working on it. I think this is a fascinating story that kind of evolved over the year. You have not just, it's many different aspects of drones. You have Facebook working on and investing in drones to deliver internet access. You have Google and Amazon investing in drones for deliveries. And then on top of that, recently we have the FAA kind of thinking up rules to kind of keep it all under control. Because when it comes to these drones and how easy it is for a consumer to buy one and throw on a GoPro, you see a lot of people using them for wedding videos. You see people using them at work with, if they're farmers, they could just use their drone to monitor their land. And then some people are using drones to get into airspace and cause, you know,
right, by airports.
Near misses.
Yeah, by airports.
Yeah, so there's problems. But there's some worry when you hear about reports of the FAA considering very strict rules on using these machines, because there's talk that and reports that you might have to have a full pilot's license to even fly something that is 2 pounds. And that is so extreme, we could be seeing issues where people aren't going to be able to take advantage of this technology. They're going to be held back. There's not going to be as much innovation if people don't want to go to pilot school to be able to just fly a GoPro around.
You got to think that's like the opening bid, you know, in this negotiation that's going to go on.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll start on this radical end on this side. You guys are on the other end. You want everything. We want nothing. And so there's somewhere we'll meet in the middle, right?
And the part that's so contradictory is that if you're not using it for business purposes, if it's just recreational, you don't have to have that license. So suddenly, if you're that farmer and you just want to have some fun out there, there's no big deal. But if you want to use it to monitor your crops, then we have an issue. I think this is going to be fascinating. And you have Amazon now who wants to try this, and they go, you know what, if we can't test it here, we're going to go to a different country and take it elsewhere. And you don't want to see that happen.
Well, you know, there is a sports pilot's license also, so maybe there's some give in there that you can be a sports pilot drone license.
If you want to take a class, and people might be open for that, you know.
Mariette, some other thoughts on what happened this year or where we're going forward?
Yeah, I personally can't wait to have a drone. But anyway, one thing I thought would be remiss if I didn't mention, since last year, the past year and a half or so, the story of the government shutdown and the problems that created for science was so important, I think everybody would want to know that this year it looks like Congress can agree, at least, on a $100 trillion omnibus bill that's 1,600 pages long, that includes many policy riders about science. And Liz already mentioned that NASA got a little extra money. They got $500 million more. There's also a bit more funding for Ebola. But the larger story for science, and DARPA got a 3% or so increase, so the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. So defense got a little bit more, but mainly science agencies are mostly at status quo with some really interesting limitations. And although earlier, you know, in the course correcting way of science, I was speaking very hopefully about climate, I saw continuing, let's say, congressional problems maybe with the idea of fostering activity on climate. So there are some writers.
You're a politician.
I'm so sorry.
Such a diplomat. Instead of saying that climate deniers have taken over Congress in the committees, right? The congressional committees.
Yeah, I mean, I think that wouldn't be an unreasonable.
You're just tiptoeing through it. That's right.
Well, so concretely, right. In some places, for instance, EPA is not allowed to use funding that would benefit climate. Like, for instance, we were just talking about farmers and drones. Mm-hmm. EPA can't use funding to require farmers to report greenhouse gases that come from manure management systems or to put it politely, the gases released by cows. Mm-hmm. and Obama can't fulfill his pledge to give $3 billion to the UN Green Climate Fund. So there are many riders along these lines that limit the ability to act at the agency level.
It will be interesting to see how this the layout of the new Congress does affect, you know, science funding.
Yeah, I just want to say one quick thing about that, you know, because people often put Republicans in the category of not favoring science. But from a business perspective, I mean, economists have told us that a third to a half of all of U.S.'s economic growth since World War II is on the back of basic research. So not the applied stuff, but the basic stuff that was funded with no particular output. So it's actually really beneficial to invest in basic research. And there are dozens and dozens of examples of this.
Well, and we've talked about this. Something we talked about on the program all year was the difference between the grassroots movement for green energy versus what you hear the national debate being. Because you have states like Iowa and Nebraska, people there really are benefiting and they are installing wind and solar projects, and they don't want to lose the tax credits because they think they know that it creates real businesses there.
Well, I think what we can say about that is just as people, as you said, the 60s, just as people were taking to the streets, people through their actions collectively, buying solar panels, we had a big feature story about that in Scientific American this year as well, taking those wind credits and things, those will eventually force the policy leaders to follow suit.
Mm-hmm. Bridget, do you have any final thoughts on stuff that are on your list?
Well, I can say it was an interesting year when I got to shake hands with a robot.
was it a satisfying experience?
You know, Honda was taking their Asimo robot, you know, right. Out for a tour to show how its hands are just so, there's so much control over the fingers that now it can do sign language. And then a couple months later, I go to a cruise ship that has a robot bartender. So I think we're seeing more and more investment in robots for entertainment, but I don't know how much it'll come for actually helping us around the house.
We're also seeing more, and there was a story at the end of the year, about prosthetics being controlled by people's brains now. Mm-hmm. Brain stories coming out, more and more of that. Liz, do you have a final story for us?
I think Europa, so this is Jupiter's moon Europa, which has a subsurface ocean with ice sheets. A study this past year showed that it has active plate tectonics. So it's just another reason why Europa is a great place to try to find life in our solar system, because those active plate tectonics.
There you go with the real estate values on that.
But it could bring minerals or things, organics, brought from comets and asteroids down into that subsurface ocean. So it's a really great target for future missions for NASA or European Space Agency or private.
Wasn't there also some talk about maybe going to Saturn? Because was it Enceladus had an incredible amount of stuff going on underneath that might rival Europa?
Yeah, so Enceladus, which is one of Saturn's very smaller moons, scientists have known for about 10 years that it has these plumes of water and other ices or liquids that are coming from somewhere. And research from this past year showed that it probably had, or it very, very likely has, a sea underneath its surface. And the idea is if you send another mission over to Enceladus and you can fly through these plumes and sort of taste what's underneath the surface in this sea and taste to see if there's any sort of life there. So these are two really wet moons around the giant planets in our solar system and really great targets for future missions.
Yeah, when we were at JPL earlier this year, speaking of news, we were talking to scientists there who say that they're already drawing up contingency plans if they want to change, you know, going from Europa to Enceladus. Liz, do you think this 2015 is going to be a big year for space and planetary exploration?
Certainly planetary. You have Rosetta, who's going to keep sending back information that it's finding from the surface of this comet. And you have the New Horizons probe, which is heading to Pluto. It's big moon Charon. It just woke up earlier this month, and it will fly by in mid-July. And then you have the Dawn spacecraft, which is another NASA mission, which will get to, it already studied one asteroid a few years ago, Vesta, and it's about to get to Ceres early in 2015. So there's going to be a lot of planetary, I think, for 2015.
Anything with other countries exploring our solar system, that they're going to be continuing.
The European Space Agency is still showing its pretty big force. They have several huge missions in process right now. And in 2028, so it's a while off, but they're going to be launching the next huge X-ray mission. Even beyond that will be gravitational waves. So we talked about these ripples that the BICEP 2 may have seen in this old light. And so far in the future, a European Space Agency mission is going to try to search for these and learn more about them.
And of course, we never know what's going to come out of Curiosity there rolling around Mars, do we? Something new all the time.
Yeah, it just detected spikes in methane, which could be produced from water interacting with rocks, or it could be produced from, probably not, but you never know, from life somewhere. But this is, it did detect some weird spikes in methane over the course of a few measurements.
That's fascinating. I want to thank all of my guests this hour. We've run out of time. Looks like an exciting 2015 ahead of us. Mariette DeCristina, Editor-in-Chief, Senior Vice President of Scientific American. Liz Cruzy, Contributing Editor at Astronomy Magazine. Bridget Carey, host of CNET Update, Senior Editor at CNET.com. Have a great holiday season. Happy New Year to everybody.